The Hanford Nuclear Reservation comprises 586 square miles in southeastern Washington. It was selected during World War II as a site for processing plutonium, and it's where the plutonium used in the atomic bombing of Nagasaki was produced. This expansive site eventually housed 9 reactors and 5 processing plants, and it continued to operate until the end of the Cold War. It now collectively holds the largest accumulation of radioactive waste in the Western Hemisphere. In the 1970s, as environmental protection was becoming a national priority, Hanford began to focus on the cleanup of the waste that resulted from plutonium production. One of the first environmental engineers hired was Melvin R. Adams, who went on to work at Hanford for 24 years. Adams is the author of Atomic Geography, a personal history of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which was published last year by Washington State University Press. In addition to personal anecdotes and insights into the management of contaminants at Hanford, Atomic Geography also reveals the paradox of this complex landscape, a radioactive waste site once purposed for atomic destruction that is also a wildlife refuge. It even includes his poetic response to this historical anomaly. Mel, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate you being here.
You're welcome.
So, just to get started, can you tell me a little bit about your personal background?
Well, my personal background was I grew up in the desert of southeast Oregon, and was cattle in the country. And I got a scholarship to go to Oregon State College or University at that time. And I majored in science, and later on I got a master's degree in geology and biology. And I actually taught high school for a number of years and then decided to go into the new field of environmental engineering. So I went back to engineering school and got a major in environmental engineering. And there was a job open up here at Hanford, and this was in 1979. Because they were just starting to get interested in cleanup, although they were still making plutonium for weapons at that time. So I was probably one of the first environmental engineers hired at Hanford and was part of a small group that had been assembled to start working on environmental issues. And now, of course, the site is completely shut down, has been for years as far as making plutonium, and it's entirely devoted now to cleanup because Hanford has, it's a very complex set of waste sites that are some of them very difficult to deal with, and so now it's totally devoted to that, and there's over $2 billion a year being spent on cleanup and will be for decades to come. So that's kind of the scope of the problem.
Absolutely. And so tell me, what made you decide to write this memoir, this personal history of your experience at Hanford?
Well, I spent 24 years there, starting out as an environmental engineer and ultimately an engineering manager. And I found many of the sites at Hanford to be just totally intriguing. And I also had some really unique experiences, I thought, with not only the people I worked with, but with the Department of Energy. And I realized that Hanford was totally misrepresented quite often in the press and in the general consciousness of people, because it's not really a reactor that a nuclear power site. Although there is a commercial reactor out there, it's on leased land, but it's private, held by a private utility. So Hanford was totally devoted to making plutonium, and it was it made most of the plutonium for our nuclear stockpile during the Cold War, and was used on the Hiroshima bomb that helped defeat Japan in World War II. So,
wow.
it was a really unique culture and still is to a certain degree. The town of Richland was actually built by the government. They even established four churches, one of which is I go to. They built a complete using what's called alphabet houses. These were standard designs of different kinds of houses that were used to house the operators of Hanford. But during the construction, there were like 50,000 people living out there in tents and trailers and barracks to actually build the place. But of course, it was a culture of total secrecy. I think among those 50,000 people, probably only maybe five knew what they were working on or why they were working on it. So that was a, when I arrived in 1979, it was still a culture of secrecy and security in many ways. It's loosened up a lot, of course, now that all the plutonium is gone from the site and they're just totally devoted to cleanup. But, for instance, every year, a government agent would come around and interview all our neighbors and coworkers to see if we were up to anything suspicious or if we were in debt or had drinking or drug problems or anything that might subject us to vulnerability, because the Russians were very active here as trying to glean secrets and access to the files and so forth.
Wow.
So it was a very secret environment. Later on, of course, the city of Richland was established, became free of the government control, and the houses were sold to individuals.
Okay.
And I actually live in one of the houses built by the government. So
you're still living in Hanford after retiring?
Yeah, I still live in Richland, which is the closest town. There's really no people living out on Hanford, per se.
Okay.
It's 580 square miles, and beginning of World War II, there were farms out there, and they were removed. Farmers were removed and hasn't been occupied by residents ever since.
And how was Hanford originally selected as a site for the production of plutonium?
Well, the Army, you know, the President Roosevelt at that time, in part prompted by a letter from Einstein, was worried that the Germans were going to develop nuclear weapons. So he established the Manhattan Project, which is a totally secret project. And Hanford was selected as the main place to make plutonium. For one thing, it's a desert, and it was very isolated at that time, and there was plenty of water. It's right next to the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm.
The Grand Coulee Dam upstream provided ample power, so they needed a lot of electricity. And there weren't that many farmers to move off the land, and so it was a kind of a natural place.
Mm.
So the Army flew over it in a light plane. They were exploring sites throughout the West, and when they saw this, they this is it as far as ideal conditions.
And this was the main site for plutonium production in the U.S.
Yeah. Right.
And so
I think like 60%, I think that's the figure, is of the plutonium was made here. So that was a major goal here.
Absolutely. And then tell me a little bit about the misconceptions that you mentioned, that people have misconceptions of Hanford. What do you think those misconceptions
are? Well, the main misconception is it's a huge toxic wasteland that threatens the Columbia River and everything like that, and it's going to kill everyone. That's just not the case. Actually, of the 580 square miles, only a small portion of that was actually used for reactors and processing plants. Now, there's no question that there were a lot of environmental issues left behind, which I go into in my book. But progress has been made on some of those, and there's a lot of work left to do. But as far as contaminating the Columbia River and posing a threat now is just not true. Okay. In fact, the groundwater plumes out there are shrinking all the time due to treatment. And most of the waste sites are either cleaned up or well under control. So although there are a few setbacks, for instance, in my book, I have a chapter about the Purex tunnels.
Yes.
Where rail cars with highly contaminated processing equipment were pushed back into these tunnels and sealed off, and they are extremely hot, so to speak. Well, here a few weeks ago, one of them collapsed. The oldest one collapsed. And DOE responded to the emergency very well and correctly, I thought. They did the right thing. And but those kinds of vulnerabilities are still out there and need to be worked on. And at this point, it just involves money and time to do it. But most of the site is not contaminated. In fact, most of it is environmentally pristine. They've found a number of species of plants that are no, and animals, particularly insects, moths. They're not found anywhere else. There's an elk herd. There's a large populations of all kinds of birds and animals. So it's basically a wildlife refuge.
Which is?
And so that was that was quite the irony, and one of the reasons I wanted to write the book.
You do, in the book you call it a place of paradox. This concrete steel monument to the birth of the nuclear age that's actually surrounded by wild terrain, which is quite a captivating image, and I think very evocative. And the stories that you tell throughout the book really kind of bring to light this paradox, where you have kind of wild animals and tumbleweeds infringing on this highly scientific and managed space. Want to ask you a little bit about the 1970s and the period in which you were brought in to work in Hanford as an environmental engineer, and that kind of transition when Hanford realized that cleanup was going to be an important part of their work. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, the site at that time was still completely devoted to making plutonium, but my boss who was a civil engineer, was hired to form a small group to start working on some of the environmental issues. So we were kind of a small renegade group. I've got a few stories about that in the book. And we basically started trying to get a handle on all the waste sites and what was in them and what could be done about them just conceptually. And that eventually led to some detailed engineering and some demonstration projects, which then further down the road led to some real success at cleanup, particularly of groundwater and contaminated soils and contaminated biota, in other words, plants and animals. So that was an important part of the group that was set up. And there weren't very many environmental engineers. I may have been the only one for quite a while. But there were geologists and groundwater hydrologists and biologists and kinds of engineers. So it was pretty interesting.
And you were really brought in the context of kind of as of environmental protection becoming a national priority in the U.S.
Yeah, I just had finished my work in environmental engineering, so I was kind of up to date on that new field of engineering. And so they felt that they needed me up here, so I took the job and worked there 24 years. So.
And tell me about some of the projects that you were involved in early on, in that kind of initial push to really figure out what the scale and scope of waste cleanup would be.
Well, I never will forget my first job assignment. We had some large ponds. Three of them were man-made ponds, you know, but one was natural. But anyway, the waters that were discharged were discharged in very large quantities and were contaminated to some degree. So my boss was aware that a lot of new environmental laws have been passed, particularly under President Nixon. Believe it or not, he did some good things. I want you to write a analysis of how these laws are going to affect the cleanup of these ponds. So I wrote this paper called Pond Management and the Law, and I pointed out that there were some major laws, including CERCLA and RCRA, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, that were going to have a big impact, and several other laws were going to have a big impact on how Hanford was run. And so this went out to review, like all the documents written at Hanford. And it was scoffed at by almost everyone out there in the technical and management ranks, because they thought all they would ever have to worry about is the Atomic Energy Act, which basically regulates, you know, nuclear weapons and such.
Mm.
They didn't believe my paper. So I just put it in a desk drawer, and 6 months later, the agreement was signed between the Environmental Protection Agency of the State of Washington and the Department of Energy to require that Hanford comply with all these laws.
Hmm.
And that never changed Hanford. I mean, as far as now, it was highly regulated, it was highly supervised. It was, you had to do certain kinds of documentation and follow certain kinds of rules. And so that really was meant that our group had to do detailed catalogs of everything that was out there to start with. And that took quite a while, because there's so many different sites and different kinds of sites.
How many sites are there?
There's a figure in my book. There's well over 1,000.
Wow.
And there's a number of groundwater plumes, some of which were, yeah, there's 1,800 wear sites, 1,400 facilities, 9 plutonium production reactors. Then there's 100 square miles of contaminated groundwater. That's less now because they've been pumping and treating a lot of that, removing it.
Mm.
56 million gallons of waste in 177 underground tanks. That's really where the most difficult problems lie. And so well over $1 billion a year is being spent on a plant to recover the waste, those 56 million gallons, and convert them to glass.
Wow.
For permanent storage.
But you're skeptical about that approach in the book.
Yeah, I was. And, of course, under our new president, the budget is under tight scrutiny. Mm-hmm. And Congress, as I predicted, would eventually get skeptical of spending billions of dollars, well over $1 billion a year just on that part of Hanford, to build these amazingly complex plants to turn the waste into glass. And they actually create a lot of problems themselves. But the main issue I had is that Hanford has always been dominated by chemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And there was very little attention given to geotechnical engineering. In other words, processes where you work with the geology and the land to come up with solutions to these problems. So we developed quite a few techniques so we could in situ dispose. In other words, leave the waste where they are.
Mm.
And instead of digging them up at great expense and exposure to workers and so forth, and then just putting them in a new place, just leave them where they are and basically seal them off from plants, animals, snow, rain, and all, wind.
Mm.
And there's ways to do that could last for thousands of years. So I thought a lot of the tanks could have been disposed in situ.
Mm.
Plus the computer modeling of the groundwater showed that even if you did nothing to these wastes and they all leaked into the ground, there was still no threat to the Columbia River for a number of reasons. Now, I'm not saying that we should just do nothing, but there were ways to deal with those wastes in place for far less money. And they're still years away from starting up that glass plant. And there's been a lot of technical issues, some of which they've solved. So I guess I'm feeling a little better about it, but I don't think that they're going to be able to sustain the funding level to actually get that done. Maybe at all, but just my feeling.
But there are issues
that,
with those tanks leaking to some extent.
Yeah, they have. There's quite a few of them have leaked, but those often lead to hysteria. But the fact is that they have been pumped so that all the pumpable liquid has been removed. And the leaks that have occurred have not really been the cause of the groundwater contaminants. What was the cause of the groundwater contaminants is that when the processing plants and the reactors were operating, they pumped billions of gallons of water directly to the ground year after year after year. And that's what caused these groundwater plumes for the most part. So the leaking tanks, it's like building the golden barn after the horses have run off. The real reason was all that groundwater that was, or all that water was pumped to the ground directly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tanks have been relatively insignificant in the groundwater pollution at Hanford. And that is just, a lot of people just don't want to hear that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure they're going to go ahead and continue with the glass plant unless Congress cuts them off money-wise, which is likely. And a plant that complex, based upon our past history at Hanford, it's going to be up and down, up and down. There's going to be all kinds of issues and problems. It may not operate consistently, but they'll probably operate it long enough to crap it up, and then we'll be faced with a huge, complex facility that'll have to be cleaned up in the future. So, no, it wasn't my favorite. In fact, the environmental impact statements that were done showed that in-situ disposal was far less expensive and far safer to both the workers and the environment, but it required a geotechnical approach instead of a chemical engineering approach, and there was kind of a bias, perception bias that was at work. So it was just never going to happen to do in situ disposal.
And when was that glass plant originally proposed? That was during your time at Hanford.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was.
So this has actually been a long time in the making.
It's been a while. It's they've been working on it for, what, maybe 10 years now.
Okay.
Ever since I retired, been under construction, and it still isn't finished. So all the studies were done probably 20 years ago.
Okay. And can you tell me a little bit about the growth of the environmental group? So it started with your boss, who was a civil engineer. He hires you, one of the first environmental engineers at Hanford. And then you have a small group of a handful of people that eventually grows to about 120 employees, solely dedicated to looking at the environmental effects and cleanup of this plutonium processing site. Can you tell me about that evolution and that increased focus on cleanup and on environmental impact and how that grew over time?
Well, I was given the job of managing one of the groups, and we had 120 people and millions of dollars of contractors were involved, and six managers. But there were other groups that did other things.
Okay, so for instance, more than 120 employees.
Oh, yeah. Eventually there was like, well, right now there's probably 8,000 people out there, and they're all involved in cleanup in one way or another.
Right.
So it became very the dominant thing to do out there. But my personal history was managing the environmental engineering group, and our job was groundwater, plants and animals, plant and animal control, groundwater, drilling new monitoring wells, cleanup of soil sites, and that kind of thing.
Did you find that plants and animals would be contaminated? I mean, you mentioned your original report about on pond management and the law, which was poorly received, but probably retrospectively the people who read it should have thought more carefully about it at the time. But while you were writing that report, you write about how many coyotes you saw at that pond, at one of the ponds that you were investigating, kind of despite the contaminated water, that these were virtual wildlife refuges. But you'd seen more coyotes there than you'd seen kind of on the desert plains of Oregon. So, I mean, did you find instances of animal contamination?
Yes, we did. We had a group called the Bugs and Bunny Boys. For some reason, there weren't any women involved at that time, but there should have been. But and they called themselves the Weeds.
Mm.
And they had to deal with contaminated tumbleweeds on a large area called the BC control area. And what would happen is that Russian thistle would put down very deep roots and go down into where some of the wastewaters had been deposited and contaminated the sediments. And they would bring up these radionuclides, and then the coyotes and badgers and rabbits and such would get exposed to these and spread the contamination around in little spots.
Mm.
So that has since been totally cleaned up and put in a engineered landfill. But at that time, it was a major job. Each year, they'd have to go out and spray to knock down the Russian thistles and then replant with native bunch grasses.
Mm.
Which did not have deep roots.
Right.
And that really helped control the contaminated tumbleweeds, because those would blow into the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very slightly contaminated, but still is not desirable to have contaminated tumbleweed floating down the Columbia River.
No. And the, the contaminated animals that you would, that your group would find, kind of what were the outcomes there?
Well, it didn't kill the animals, and we didn't either, but what we would do is try to control the plants that were available.
Okay.
So that the wouldn't be any habitat really suitable for the animals. Or we, you know, tried to clean up the site so that they wouldn't get into it. But the building where the Bugs and Bunny Boys were was really kind of a strange place. It was like a college biology lab and a farmer's barn all together. It had large spraying equipment in there and farm equipment, but they also had freezers full of contaminated animals that they had collected to be analyzed. And they were also called in to do other biological control things, like rattlesnakes would quite often get into the buildings out there because the buildings were kind of in the middle of a, you know, sagebrush desert, and things would get in there like rattlesnakes or rabbits or whatever. Even had coyotes try to get in. And, of course, some of the employees got kind of upset when they saw snakes in the hallway. So they had to go in and get the snakes out. And but one of the most unusual calls we got was Mattel, which is the national lab, does all kinds of scientific work, still do. And they were doing a lot of experiments with mice. Well, some of the mice got loose, and it was really wrecking the protocols of their experiment. So the guys were called down to capture these live mice. So they said, well, we need some rolled oats and peanut butter. We need quite a bit of it to bait the traps. Because they used live traps.
Mm.
So I wrote out an emergency order so they could just go down to the store and buy these things. And they caught the mice before they did too much damage to the experiments. And later on, after the bills came back, I had a lot of different managers. One of the glories of working at Hanford, you had 5 or 6 managers. One of them came in and said, "What are you doing, trying to feed your family on the government dollar? What's all this rolled oats and peanut butter for?" So I explained to him, and he went away kind of sheepish. Because he thought I was buying rolled oats and peanut butter to feed my family.
Mm. And did they?
So we got involved in all kinds of strange projects like that.
I mean, you have kind of several anecdotes in your in the book, and you have a whole chapter dedicated to anomalies and unusual events at Hanford. You mentioned the Purex, the railroad tunnels, one of which had the roof collapse in May, as you mentioned. And you talk about these and other forms of burial grounds, which also kind of create this very interesting visual picture of all of these kind of, you know, contaminated railways and things that then get kind of ushered into these underground tunnels because they've been contaminated by the materials that they've carried over time. Could you talk a little bit more about some of these kind of oddities that you kind of experienced and discovered at Hanford?
Yeah, one of the most intriguing places at Hanford, and I have a chapter about it in the book, was U Pond. And U Pond was a pond where wastewater is from labs and the laundry and other facilities went. So much water was put to this pond that it was basically just a low spot in the terrain, and it became a pond because of so much water. And was being put to it. And it became kind of a oasis for wildlife. But the interesting thing about it is that it also had a very high level of plutonium in it. So it became kind of a mecca for PhDs and scientists to study how plutonium moves throughout the environment. So there's a lot of research done on new ponds. And I said in the book that I thought it was probably the most studied pond in the world. And some of the studies were quite interesting. They found, for instance, that plutonium is not very mobile in the environment, at least in the soils and groundwater. It just doesn't. In fact, we brought a machine up from the Nevada test site to try to wash some plutonium out of the soil, and you just couldn't do it. It was so tightly bound. So that's one of the things they learned, is that plutonium is not very mobile unless it's organically complexed. It just doesn't move very, very well in the soil or groundwater. They did all kinds of studies on how much the animals were uptaking and what kinds of animals were visiting the pond, and all the birds and insects they did studies on, and it was just intriguing. And you go down there, it looked just like a nice fishing pond. And it was, had a dock and a little boat.
Oh.
It was full of goldfish. Someone had planted goldfish in there. And the goldfish flourished, as they also did in some of the other ponds. And when the new pond was eventually drained and covered and stabilized, they found tens of thousands of goldfish in there. So things can really live in these environments because the radiation levels were just not that high. And they, you know, living things are pretty adaptable.
So they're living there despite the plutonium concentrations. There's not any relationship between the plutonium concentrations and this high level of life there. Okay, so it's...
It was just because water was put it so much into the desert,
yes,
it became just like a magnet. And interestingly enough, in my study of pond management and the law, I found an obscure state regulation that said if you destroy habitat in the desert, basically, you have to replace it. Well, when they decommissioned Gable Mountain Pond and U Pond, they destroyed the habitat for a lot of animals and birds and insects and so on and so forth. And so they should have replaced it, habitat, with a clean pond, but they didn't, of course. So, but that was an interesting thing that most people weren't aware of, that there is a regulation on that. So it was just an intriguing place. That's enough plutonium in Gable in the U Pond to make a Nagasaki bomb, if you could get it out of the sediment and concentrate it, but that's impossible to do because, like I said, you can't even wash it out, so, on purpose. So it's pretty much stuck there in the sediments, and I don't know if they'll someday dig that all up and put it in a landfill or not, but right now it's really not a problem. So I don't know if they'll get around to that or not.
But quite amazing to think that all of that plutonium is concentrated in kind of a relatively small area, yet still somehow managed to not be harmful to all of these creatures.
Well, there was another chapter in my book about the trench, which had received even more plutonium. And I didn't work on this project, but the plutonium levels were so high they thought there might be a criticality, you know, where the plutonium gets together in the right configuration to actually cause the reaction, the chain reaction. That would not have been desirable.
No.
And so they actually went in there with robots to examine and mine some of the sediment out of that trench. And I forget exactly how much plutonium they eventually took out of that. And they also put down some poison so that the plutonium could not fission. But it was... Yeah, plutonium did accumulate sometimes, but it just it was very difficult to get it out of there. You had to basically dig it out.
And tell me a little bit about living in Richland, which, as you mentioned, was a town created specifically for the workers employed at Hanford. You mentioned kind of how it was kind of very strategically constructed. Amenities were created, kind of social centers like churches were created in this town. Can you tell me a little bit about life there, especially because I imagine all of your kind of friends and neighbors are also incredibly integrated in the life of the Hanford Reservation.
Yeah, of course, that's completely changed. Now the area is booming for other reasons. But that's good. But when I arrived in 79, there was still plutonium production going on. So there was still this culture of secrecy. And like I said, the annual visits by federal agents and all of that. My wife never saw where I worked. I was never able to take a camera out there to photograph it. So she, to this day, doesn't really understand what I did. Of course, she read the book, but it was just a very different kind of a culture. It wasn't that difficult to adjust to, but it wouldn't certainly be for everyone. Now a lot of that has completely eased up. It's completely different. But I got a helicopter going over. Anyway, the culture was such that they would, if you burned out a light bulb in your house, you just called up General Services Administration. They would come change your light bulb. That kind of, later on, of course, after the homes were sold and the city of Richland was incorporated.
When was that? When did that happen?
I'm going to say in the 70s.
Okay.
Yeah, early 70s, I think, is when they... But a lot of the, of course, all of the government houses are still here in the older part of town. And some of them have been totally refurbished and modified. Like we're modifying our house right now, adding another addition to it. So they're very, very well-made houses. They, even though they built a whole block in a week... These houses were made of very sturdy beams and planks that you can't even get anymore. So they're very, very sturdy houses, and they're very amenable to being added onto and that kind of thing. So.
And tell me a little bit more about the culture of secrecy at Hanford. So Hanford was producing plutonium until the end of the Cold War in 1988. And so over almost, let's say, a 9-year period of your time there, there must have been this continued kind of culture of secrecy where, and it was obviously the government had you know, very high stakes in what was going on at Hanford. So can you tell me, I mean, what it was like to... Yeah, to work there, to work among colleagues who were working on something that where they didn't really understand or know the final purpose of their work.
Well, of course, we knew because the secret was out after the Nagasaki bomb was dropped. But
yes.
We really couldn't... we were working on a project that required a Q clearance. We really couldn't share those documents. Those documents were strictly controlled. They had to be put away every day and secured, and you could not, of course, take them home or we couldn't photograph them. I mean, you just couldn't access them except during working hours.
Mm.
Of course, our lunch boxes were searched coming in and going out every day.
Mm.
Where we had badges and you didn't want to leave it at home because you couldn't get in. I remember sometimes working on weekends and going out into the hall to be confronted with a fully armed guy in a black vest and helmet and everything with a machine gun. Because what are you doing here? And I had to explain it to him.
Mm.
So there were there's just a lot of secrecy and security.
You mentioned even that your wife didn't always kind of know the full extent of what was going on at Hanford. I would imagine that would be the same for several spouses of employees at the site.
Yeah.
I mean, did that affect your kind of social lives in Richland, where you're imagined socializing with other people who are working at Hanford, because that would have, you know, employees would have made up the majority of the town's population? I mean, affect your kind of, recreational lives?
Well, it sort of did. Although the time I got here, was towards the end of the Cold War, so that was starting to ease up a bit. There wasn't as much. A lot of people still couldn't talk about their jobs if they were dealing with secret materials. So I didn't discuss that with anyone. But people generally knew what I was doing. They just weren't able to see what I was doing because of the restrictions.
Yes, of course.
And I remember going by the guardhouse on the morning of 9/11 after the New York attacks. And I said to the guard, you better increase security because there's something going on back east.
Mm.
And they did almost immediately clamp down on security at the site. So, it did affect your life quite a bit. For instance, during these annual visits by federal agents, you had to answer questions about your coworkers. They asked questions that would be unimaginable today, like, you know, are you gay? Are you a drug addict? Or are you in debt? You know, those kinds of things. So it was, you didn't have much privacy as far as that goes.
No.
There's a lot of changes that have occurred. For instance, every year some monks come in and this is usually during the anniversary of the Nagasaki bomb dropping.
Mm.
And they will walk clear out to Hanford in the stifling heat. And it's pretty well accepted. Their protests are pretty well accepted.
Mm.
And they're supported by the churches and so forth.
Mm.
So that's a change. The main cultural difference is that Hanford is becoming less and less important in our economy. And there's concerns about the budgets and layoffs and things like that.
Mm.
But so it's not as dominant as it used to be culturally, not even close.
Well, and of course, I'm sure the employment, you know, the numbers have changed dramatically since plutonium production stopped.
It
became really just a cleanup operation.
Yeah, although the site still had roughly the same number of employees, they just didn't do the same job.
Okay.
Because cleanup, in a way, is just as difficult as creating plutonium.
Yes.
In fact, they just completely took down the plutonium finishing facility where a lot of the plutonium was processed, and that was a very tricky long-term job to get that done.
And I want to then kind of move towards the transition, so this kind of full-scale evolution of Hanford from a nuclear production site to a national park, which really, I think, exemplifies this paradox that you write about in the book. So in 2000, you mentioned that Clinton created the Hanford Reach National Monument along the Columbia River. And then in 2015, the Manhattan Project National Historical Park opened, which includes Hanford. Can you talk about this idea of Hanford as a national park and Hanford's future?
Well, the part of the Hanford that was created by the Hanford Reach National Monument is just it's the last free-flowing part of the Columbia River. And it's just gorgeous. You can take jet boat tours up the river, and you'll see all kinds of wildlife and the White Bluffs, which are unique geologically. There's the historical park at Hanford includes only B reactor, mm-hmm. but that's fascinating because it's been preserved in its pretty much original configuration. So there's the tours that go out there are sold out instantly. The National Park Service will eventually get more access to some of these things like B reactor. And as far as the Reach National Monument, there's going to be a lot more access both from land and from the river in the future, so people can camp and so forth.
Mm.
There is parts of Hanford, though, that have been really restricted and kind of still are. For instance, Rattlesnake Mountain is quite a place as far as this diversity of plants and animals. There's animals that are found nowhere else in the world, plants, but there's unique species of animals, lots of moths that are totally unique. Insects, they think there may be as many as 15,000 different insect species out there, which is, most have not been cataloged.
Mm.
There's elk herds, there's burrowing owls, there's all kinds of shorebirds along the river. So it's just because it was isolated so long, it has really been undisturbed. There hasn't been a lot of environmental degradation. So, unfortunately, Trump is reviewing the national monuments that were created under the Democrats, and he may try to dispose of Hanford Reach. I don't think he'll be able to do it, but it'd be a real shame because it is a very unique area.
And I think he'll get a lot of opposition from Washington state politicians. But you write as well about, you mentioned elk earlier, kind of who had migrated into the Hanford area after the 1930s, precisely because it kind of became this de facto protected area, in a sense, obviously for, not in the same way that we think about national parks, but because the farms were removed, and great kind of swaths of land were undevelopable. You write about these elk that came in and kind of as a potential kind of symbol for future reintroduction of species or really rewilding of Hanford. Which I think is really interesting to think about this place that had been so scientifically managed, really a place that was intended to produce material for destruction, and now you have this life that kind of comes in on its own.
Yeah, it's a total paradox.
Mm. And I think you're, I didn't mention that you are also a poet, which I think is probably one of the reasons that your memoir is so beautifully written. But the book does include poems at the end that really demonstrate this paradox quite beautifully.
Thank you. Yeah. I've always responded to the place poetically. I don't know really too many others that have, but I think a lot of people appreciate the poetic interpretation of Hanford, but it's because it is such a paradox, it's really an interesting place to write poetry about.
And do you continue to write poetry?
Yes, I do. I write more of poetry about nature and the spiritual dimension of nature. I do through my church and so forth. And I've actually written a book of poetry that I self-published and won quite a few contests and published in journals and such. So I'm a poet in residence for my church.
Oh, wow.
But most churches don't have a poet in residence.
I've never heard of a poet in residence. I think you are the first poet in residence that I've heard of. And what are your plans next? What are you working on?
I'm thinking about writing a... When I was in college, I worked for the Forest Service for 4 summers, surveying logging roads. And I'm thinking about writing a memoir of those experiences.
Fantastic. No, it sounds wonderful. I'm sure I will look forward to reading that in the future as well. But
because a lot of unique things happen. I got very well acquainted with the Fremont National Forest. And it's also a very unique place, both historically and naturally. So I thought it might be worth a book. I don't know if I've got the energy, but we'll try.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And it's been fantastic to speak to you about Hanford and your experiences and your book. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
That was my interview with Melvin Adams, author of Atomic Geography, A Personal History of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Environmental Studies.